Boa tarde. Obrigado a todos por estarem aqui presentes. A primeira visita do Richard Stallman no Porto. Deverão disculpar que está um pouco cansado porque chegou há uns poucos minutos, vinha de comboio e teve também umas viagens nos últimos dias, por isso está um pouco assim a adormecer. Mas de qualquer forma, temos aqui uma grande honra de receber a Richard Stallman, que como vocês com certeza sabem, foi o criador, entre muitas coisas, foi quem criou o primeiro compilador C do projeto GNU, que faz possível compilar o kernel Linux e criar todo o sistema operativo GNU.
This is all backwards.
No, I'm talking about the kernel.
Right.
And you're saying that
GCC is just one program. It's not
just
what
one program.
Is all about.
No, I'm saying among your technical merits, it is one of them is building the GNU CC compiler that makes it possible to have a complete operating system. But besides that, ya que la palestra va a ser en inglés, es mejor comenzarmos a hablar en inglés. Among that, besides having a very good technical merit, what makes Richard Stallman outstanding is that he dedicated his life to the good of people, to the good of society, and he opted to have a simple life and to work for his political ideals for a better society. And that's what he's going to talk about today. Not on technical details, but on the social aspects of the free software movement. So please welcome Richard Stallman.
Well, after that, I will try my best to stay awake to give you a speech. The work of developing the GNU system is a technical activity, developing software. But the issue I'm going to speak about is not a technical issue. It's a social, ethical, and political issue. It's the issue of what the rules of society should be for using software. Most of the time when people raise that question, they work for software companies, so they raise it in a self-serving direction. They ask, what rules can we impose on you to make you pay us a lot of money? And I'm sure you're familiar with the answers they get. Well, I had the good fortune in the 1970s to be part of a community of programmers who shared software. And because of that, I was led to ask myself that question from a different direction, to ask what kind of rules make for a good society, good to live in for the people in it. And I reached completely different answers. Let me say a little about what that community was like. It included programmers at some of the best universities, and sometimes even programmers at computer companies participated. The lab where I worked was the deepest part of the community because there, all the software we used was the community's software. In most universities, the community's software was used on top of some operating system that might have been non-free typically. But in our lab, we had written our own time-sharing system, the incompatible time-sharing system, or ITS for short. And thus, we were able to use completely the free software of our own community. And so we had a life where we were free. We weren't restricted and dominated by the owners of software. So I got to see what life could be like in freedom, which even in the 1970s was already an unusual opportunity. Most computer users did not live in freedom. Now the light's going off. Are we running out of battery power or something? Good, thank you. I guess in a developing country, these things are not as reliable as in some parts of the world. It's varying again. Well, I'll try to ignore it. Sleepy as I am, you see, I tend to be easily distracted. It's hard to focus my mind, but I will try my best to focus. So, we had an operating system written by the programmers at the lab called the Incompatible Timesharing System. Now, this name is obviously a joke, but it was the name for many years of serious work. And that shows you the hacker spirit. The hacker spirit is to have fun and make jokes even when the work you're doing is also completely serious. In fact, I don't understand this, do you? In fact, there's an expression, ha-ha, only serious, which represents that aspect of hacker culture. So in our community, if you walk past another hacker's screen, gee, there's a big me up there. Saw something interesting on the screen, you'd say, hey, what is that? And he would say, that's the new FUBAR program, which we just got from Stanford, and it's in the FUBAR directory. So in the FUBAR directory, you would find the source code. Sorry, you'd find the executable that you could run, and you'd also find the source code, which you could read and study to see how they solved those problems. In running a program, you'd probably encounter some bugs, and you might have ideas to improve the program. So you could go to the source code, and you could fix the bugs. You could add new features, make it bigger. You could even cut a piece out of it and put it into some other program you were writing. We called that cannibalizing the old program, which was another joke, because unlike cannibalizing a machine for spare parts, copying part of the code did not make the program stop working. I couldn't quite hear you. Anyway, so you could use the program not just by running it, but in all the various ways that it could perhaps be useful. The software we developed was part of human knowledge. It was available to humanity to use in whatever way was useful. So I was able to feel very proud of the job that we were doing. We were not working to help one group of people defeat another group of people. After all, that's nothing particularly to be proud of. But rather, we were working for all humanity. And that was something that I could feel proud of. But then we got a taste of what life was like for most computer users, for the ones who didn't have a community like ours where they could share software and where they could use software that they could freely change and share. This happened when Xerox gave MIT a laser printer. This was a handsome gift. It was the first time anybody outside Xerox ever had a laser printer. It was the first generation of laser printer, actually an office copier that had been modified with a laser attachment to turn it into a printer. It was very fast. It printed a page a second. It had high resolution, and straight lines came out very straight. But it also had a flaw. It frequently got paper jams. And since nobody's office was very near the printer, it would stay jammed for a long time. So So overall, it didn't work very well. And over the weeks or months that followed starting to use the printer, we all noticed this. At that point, I thought of a possible solution, the same solution that we used for our old printer. Our old printer was slow and had lower resolution and tended to make straight lines a bit wavy. And in addition, it got paper jams. Since we couldn't make the printer itself any better, we were programmers, not printer engineers. So we couldn't make the printer itself better, but we could add features to the software to compensate for the problems of the printer. For instance, there was a feature that every time the printer finished a print job, the system would display a message for the user who printed it saying, "Your file foo has been printed." This way, you had to wait because the printer was slow, but you didn't have to wait extra because of not knowing when your printout was done. And there was another feature that I added myself, which was that every time the printer got in trouble, the system displayed a message on the screen for each user who was waiting for printing, saying, "The printer is in trouble, go fix it." If you got that message, you were not going to take the risk of assuming someone else would fix the problem, because you knew only a few people would get that message. So you would go immediately to the printer and fix it. The result was the printer continued to get paper jams, but a minute later, two or three users would show up, and at least one of them would know how to fix the problem and would teach the others. In effect, we treated the user as part of the system and added end-to-end feedback, and we got reliable operation for the entire system, even though the printer component was still unreliable. That worked well, so I thought of using the same feature for the new printer, but there we ran into a blank wall. Sorry, we ran into a... You can see how sleepy I am. We ran into a stone wall because we were able to make those changes for the old printer because the old printer was controlled by a free program, the community's software. We had the source code, and we could change it in any way we wanted, limited only by our skill as programmers. But the new printer was controlled by a proprietary Xerox program. We didn't have the source code, and that meant we were completely helpless. We couldn't change anything. We were, in effect, prisoners of our software. The result was constant frustration. You would type the command to print a file and go back to work, realizing there's no point going to the printer soon. A while later, you see the time. Oh, it's been half an hour. That's too fast. It's probably not done yet. Not worth it. You go back to work. And a while later, you notice the time. Oh, now it's been an hour. Maybe it's printed now. So you walk upstairs to the printer, and you see it was jammed the whole time. So you fix the jam, and you go back down to your work. And a while later, you notice the time. Oh, it's been half an hour again. Maybe it's printed now. So you walk upstairs to the printer, and you see it printed 200 pages of other people's stuff, which was 3.5 minutes for this fast printer, and then jammed again. And at that point, you say, "I'm going to stand here and fix this damn thing every time it jams until I finally get my output." Constant frustration. It wasn't supposed to work that way, but it did work that way. And what made it even more galling was to realize that we could have solved this problem, except that somebody in Xerox was deliberately keeping us helpless, deliberately standing in our way. That stone wall was no accident. It was deliberately erected, blocking us from doing the work to solve the problem. Then I heard that somebody at Carnegie Mellon University had a copy of that source code. Eventually, I was visiting there, so I went to his office and said, "Hi, I'm from MIT. Could I have the copy of the printer software soft source code?" And he said, "No, I promised not to give you a copy." And I was not only angry, I was stunned. I never expected somebody to actually refuse to give me a copy of source code. In our community, that's not how things were done. I couldn't think of a way at that moment to express my anger adequately. All I could think of was to walk out of his office without saying another word. So I kept thinking about it afterwards. And that was paradoxically very good for me, even though his refusal to share with us was, practically speaking, very bad for us, his colleagues at the Artificial Intelligence Lab at MIT. You see, we never got that source code, and so we were never able to solve the problem, and the printer was frustrating for all the years we kept using it. But it was paradoxically beneficial for me because it taught me an important lesson, a lesson that most programmers don't learn. You see, he had promised to refuse to share with us, his colleagues at MIT, but not just with us. Chances are he did it to you too. And let's see if there's any. Could you raise the lights on the audience, please? I'm trying to see if there's anyone else. Yes, chances are he did it to you as well. I can't say he probably did it to most of you. The thing is, most of you didn't exist yet, because that was around 1980. But he had promised to refuse his cooperation to just about the entire population of planet Earth. He had signed a non-disclosure agreement, which was a promise. Can you tell what this means? Is that saying yes, hear, hear, or is that saying boo, or make it one dimming for yes and two dimmings for no. We'll establish communication here. So he had promised to refuse to cooperate with just about the entire population of planet Earth by signing a non-disclosure agreement. This was my first direct personal encounter with a non-disclosure agreement. I was the victim. I and my whole lab were the victims. And the lesson it taught me was that non-disclosure agreements have victims. They are not harmless. They are not innocent. You're promising not to help somebody who probably deserves your help. And that's a betrayal of solidarity, a betrayal of the spirit of goodwill, of the spirit of helping your neighbor. You don't know who it is you're betraying. You're signing a blank check of betrayal. I promise I will not help blank if he asks for my help. And that name is filled in later according to circumstances, perhaps with some stranger, perhaps with your brother. Most programmers first encounter a non-disclosure agreement when they're invited to sign one. And there's always some kind of goodie, some temptation that you'll get if you sign. So they make up excuses to close their eyes to the ethical issue of what they are doing. They say to themselves, He'll never get a copy anyway, so why shouldn't I join the conspiracy to deprive him? They say, this is the way it's always done. Who am I to go against this? And they say, if I don't do this, somebody else will. Various excuses to gag their consciences. But when someone invited me to sign a non-disclosure agreement, my conscience was already sensitized. It was already awake, more awake than I am now. I remembered very well how angry I had felt when someone else had done that to me, and I could not turn around and do the same thing to somebody else who didn't deserve it, probably didn't deserve it any more than I did. Because remember, I wouldn't have known who I would be doing this to. It could have been anyone. If I had been asked to promise specifically to refuse to share with that bastard at Carnegie Mellon who wouldn't share with us, that would have been perfectly right. But to refuse to share with other people who had never done me any harm, that I couldn't do. So I said, thank you so much for offering me this nice software package, but I cannot accept it in good conscience on the conditions that you have set. So I will do without it. No thanks. And thus I have never knowingly signed a non-disclosure agreement for generally useful technical information such as software. There are other kinds of information which raise different ethical issues. For instance, there is personal information, a totally different kind of issue. If you asked me if we could talk about what's happening between you and your sweetheart, and would I please not tell anybody, that I could agree to, because that's personal information. It's not generally useful technical information. At least it probably isn't. Now, I could imagine that you might disclose to me a wonderful new sex technique, and I'll probably never have a chance to use it myself, but I'd have a moral duty to pass it on to other people who might have a chance to use it. But if you just want to talk to me about soap opera stuff, do people know what a soap opera is? You know, who hurt whose feelings and what that one did in response and so on. Other people don't need to know your soap operas in order to live their lives. They have their own soap operas. So it's ethically legitimate for me to promise to keep that private for you. But when it comes to software and other forms of generally useful technical information, the mission of science and technology is to develop generally useful technical information for the world. If we withhold it instead, if we limit its use to a few favored individuals who pay more, for instance, then we're betraying the mission of our field. And this, after some years of thinking, I decided I would not do. I decided it was wrong, that nobody should do it, and that I would not do it. But during the same years, a series of blows fell on my community and wiped it out. Perhaps the final blow was when Digital Equipment Corporation discontinued the PDP-10 computer. Because the incompatible time-sharing system was written in assembler language for the PDP-10. When the PDP-10 was discontinued, 15 years of our work turned into dust and blew away. That's a heavy blow in itself, but its consequences were much worse. Because all the operating systems for modern computers were proprietary. You had to sign a non-disclosure agreement just to get the binaries. And the result was that I faced a moral dilemma. I could not continue working in my field of operating system development the way I had been doing it before, because that depended on having a free operating system to work on and improve, and a community of cooperating programmers to do it with. Both of these were gone. So that option was no longer possible. What was I going to do instead? The most obvious possibility was to accept that the world had changed and adapt myself to it, to be Shaw's reasonable man. This way, I realized, I could have fun programming and I could make money, especially if I left MIT and did it somewhere else. But I realized that that this way, at the end, I would look back and say, I have spent my career building walls to divide people, and I would be ashamed of everything I had done. So I looked for some other option, and it was easy to find one. I could leave the computer field and do something else. Many programmers find that unthinkable. They can't imagine not having employment as a programmer. So they say, if I don't do this, this, and this to get a programming job, I'll starve. That's literally what they say, but it's absurd, because even in the U.S. and certainly in Portugal, there are millions of people who don't work with computers, and they don't all starve. Now, I had no other special noteworthy skills. Yes. And I hope it does, I hope you don't have to go far away to get this, because it's a tiny amount of tea. Oh, really? In that case, next time I suggest getting a larger quantity. What was I saying? I'm struggling to remember. That's how sleepy I am. Distract me for a second and I don't even know where I am. Now, I had no other special noteworthy skills, but I'm sure I could have become a waiter. Perhaps not at a fine restaurant, but I could have been a waiter somewhere. Now, there are two things about being a waiter. Ah, that's a nice quantity of tea. I hope it can cool off in such a big... This is what?
Brown sugar.
Oh, good. There are two things about being a waiter. One is, as a waiter, you're not doing anything unethical, as long as it's not at McDonald's. And the other is, as a waiter, you're not going to starve, as long as it's not at McDonald's. The popularity of McDonald's is due to a misunderstanding of uneducated Americans. They heard the term fast food and they thought it meant rapid food. But actually, how do you say fast in Portuguese? Jejum. Jejum. To fast means to go without eating. So this food was never meant for being eaten. This is the food that you're not eating while you're fasting. Here's how it works. If you are fasting, but you're feeling hungry and you're feeling tempted to eat, you think of McDonald's food and you lose your appetite, and then you can finish your fast. So now if anybody ever suggests you should actually eat in McDonald's, you know how to explain why that's a mistake. So I had found an ethical way to survive, but I knew that being a waiter for me would be no fun at all. And it would be wasting my skills as an operating system developer. Now, wasting your skills is much better than misusing them. To develop non-free software would be misuse of my skills. And that's what the other alternative would have meant, you know, using non-free software, signing non-disclosure agreements, and almost certainly writing non-free software. So being a waiter would be much better, but still not good. So I looked for some other option. I asked myself, what can an operating system developer do in this situation that would be positive, that would make the world a better place? Leaving so soon? I hope it wasn't something I said. So I asked myself what I could do, and I realized that an operating system developer was exactly what was needed to solve this problem. The moral dilemma existed for me and for every computer user because all the operating systems for modern computers were proprietary. So if I were to, or any operating system developer, were to develop another system and make it free, give people the freedom to share it and cooperate, then we could give everybody a way out of the dilemma. I realized that this was probably the most important thing I would ever have a chance to try to do in my whole life. And I concluded that I had been elected by circumstances to do this job. It's like when you see somebody drowning. If you know how to swim and it's not Bush, then you have a duty. You have a duty to save him. Well, I don't know how to swim, but I do know how to write software. And for this job, what was needed was writing software. I saw that I was aware of this problem and nobody else was paying attention. I had the skills to try to solve the problem, and probably no one else would try to solve it if I did not. So I decided that I would develop a free software operating system or die trying, presumably of old age. Because at the time, nobody was trying to stop us. We had no enemies. We just had a lot of work to do. That decision led to other decisions, technical design decisions. What kind of system should this be? Well, I had just seen one operating system, one free software operating system, turn into dust and blow away because it was written for a specific kind of computer that became obsolete. I didn't want to write another system only to see the same thing happen. So this system had to be portable. But there was just one successful portable operating system that I knew of, and that was Unix. So I decided to follow the design of Unix. I figured that way there'd be a better chance of actually producing a system that would really work and really be portable. further, I realized that users do not like incompatible changes. I could have taken the best ideas I had seen from the various systems I had worked on and added in my own favorite ideas and made my dream operating system. But I knew that if I offered this to the users, they would have said, "That's very nice, but we've already trained our staff to use Unix and written our software to run on Unix. It would be too much work to switch to your system, so we won't switch." At that point, I would have had a ready-made excuse. I could have said, "I offered them freedom, they didn't take it, so that's their fault." But I wanted to do more than just make an excuse. So I wanted to build a real community that would actually have people living in it and enjoying the benefits of freedom. So I realized I better develop a system that people would really use. Making the system upward compatible with Unix was a way to achieve that. Upward compatible means we could add new features, if whatever we could think of, but the features of Unix should continue to work. Now, Unix consists of many different components that work together through interfaces that were more or less documented. To be upward compatible with Unix means replacing each component one by one in a compatible way, which means that the initial design decisions were already made. The remaining decisions were within one component, and those could wait till somebody actually wrote that piece. This meant that we were almost ready to start the job. All we needed was a name. We hackers like to find funny or even mischievous names for the programs we write, because thinking of users being amused by the name is half the fun of writing the program. And there was a hacker tradition that when you are writing a program similar to some existing program, you could give that program a name. And in the days before programs were portable, it was very common that you had to write a program similar to an existing program, because that other program ran on a different kind of system. If you wanted those features on your system, you were going to have to write it over again. You had to write your own program to do that job. So the tradition was, the hacker tradition was, when you're writing a program similar to an existing one, you can give your program a name, which is a recursive acronym that says that your program is not the other one. For instance, in the 60s and 70s, there were many TECO text editors, more or less similar, and most of them were called something TECO. But one clever hacker called his program TINT, for TINT is not TECO, the first recursive acronym. Well, we thought this was tremendous fun, so we looked for other chances to make recursive acronyms. In 1975, I developed the first Emacs text editor, the extensible programmable text editor. And there were many imitations of Emacs, some of them being called something or other Emacs. But one was called Fine, for Fine is not Emacs. And there was Sign, for Sign is not Emacs. And Ina, for Ina is not Emacs. And Mince, for Mince is not complete Emacs. Then Ina was mostly rewritten, and version 2 was called Zwei, for Zwei was Ina initially. Another recursive acronym you may have heard of is WINE, which stands for Wine is not an emulator. So So I look for a recursive acronym for something is not Unix. I tried the obvious four-letter approach with all 26 letters and discovered that none of them was a word, at least not in English. And if it doesn't have another meaning, it's not funny. So, not feeling very imaginative at the time, I looked for some other way to do it, and the only thing I thought of was to make a contraction, and that way I would get a three-letter recursive acronym. So I started trying letters. ANU, BNU, KNU, DNU, ENU, FNU, GNU. Well, GNU is the funniest word in the English language. It's used for a lot of wordplay. There's even a funny song that starts from the word GNU. And therefore, when I saw that that was a possible name, I couldn't resist. If you can call something GNU, how could you possibly use any other name? The reason this word is used for so much humor is, according to the dictionary, it's pronounced new. So people started asking, instead of what's new, they would ask, what's GNU? Now there's a new answer to that question. You can respond, GNU's not Unix. And this has the added merit that it sounds like you are obnoxiously telling the person what it isn't instead of telling him what it is. But in fact, you are telling him exactly what it is. So he can't really complain. Anyway, when it's the name of our operating system, don't pronounce it new. You would get people very confused if you pronounce it that way. We've been working on it 20 years now, so it's not new anymore. But it still is and always will be GNU, no matter how many people call it Linux by mistake. So, I found a name, I could start the project. I announced it on the net, asking who wants to help. And in January 1984, I quit my job at MIT to start writing parts of the GNU system. I had to quit my job because if I continued working at MIT, the MIT administration could have claimed that they owned the code I wrote and could have made it into a proprietary software product. As far as I was concerned, there was no point writing the software if it wouldn't give people freedom. In fact, I would rather not write it than let it be non-free. So by quitting my job, I took MIT out of the equation. There was nothing they could do anymore to stop me from making it free software. And I have never had a job since then. But the head of the AI lab was nice enough to let me keep using the facilities. So I started using a Unix machine there to write pieces of the GNU system. This was the first time I ever used Unix. I was not a Unix wizard, never. I chose to make GNU compatible with Unix for the precise reason I told you. Without having actually seen Unix, I had only read the manual. Fortunately, once I started actually using it, it was not too bad. There were some flaws, but they weren't horrible flaws. So I decided to continue with the plan of making the system compatible with Unix. Any chance of some more tea? Because I'm getting sleepier by the minute. I have to say.
No problem.
I didn't want to take any risk that MIT would ruin the whole thing by making it non-free. And I didn't want to have to beg the MIT administration to agree to the licenses that I was going to design. So by quitting my job, I avoided that whole area of problems. Now, at the time, I thought that I and the others I was recruiting, we would develop all these pieces, and when we had everything, we would put it together as a system, and then people would start to use it. But that's not what happened. In September 1984, I started working on GNU Emacs, which was my second implementation of the extensible editor, and I think probably the last implementation of Emacs written. By early 85, it was working well enough I could use it for all my editing. That was a big convenience, because I had no intention of learning to edit with VI. So until that point, I would edit the files on some other computer where there already was an Emacs and copy the files through the net to the Unix machine to test them. But once GNU Emacs was running, I could do the editing on the Unix machine itself. So it was convenient that I could edit with GNU Emacs. And when GNU Emacs was good enough for my editing, other people thought it would be good enough for their editing. They started asking me for copies, which meant I had to decide precisely how I would distribute GNU software packages, these pieces of the GNU system. Of course, I put a copy in the FTP server directory. That was good for programmers who were on the Internet. But in 1985, most programmers were not on the Internet. So the others were sending me messages asking, how can I get a copy? What was I going to tell them? I could have said, I want to spend my time writing more pieces of the GNU system, not writing mag tapes. So please find a friend who's on the net who can download it and put it on tape for you. And they would have got copies sooner or later because programmers generally know other programmers. But I had no job. And I was looking for some way I could make money through my work on free software. So I posted a message saying, send me $150 and I'll mail you a tape of GNU Emacs. And the orders began dribbling in. By the middle of the year, they were trickling in. I was getting 8 to 10 orders a month, which, if necessary, I could have lived on, because I have always lived cheaply. I live basically like a student, and this is an intentional choice. I don't want to get expensive habits which would effectively become traps for me. You see, if you get expensive habits, then you're forced to try to make a lot of money, and your life is controlled by the money. Most Americans, if they start making this much money, they look for a way to make this much money. So they start buying houses and cars and boats and airplanes and rare stamps, and artwork, and adventure travel, and children, various expensive luxuries that they can't really afford. And then they have to desperately spend all their time trying to make money to pay for these things, and they have no time to enjoy them. So it's entirely futile. I'm sorry, I'm just getting so sleepy. I can't even remember what I was saying a few seconds ago. I actually fell asleep for a second. But if you resist those expensive habits, then you can decide what to do with your life. You can do something that's really important instead of being a puppet of money. So the fact that I rejected the expensive habits I could have sought meant that I was still in command of my own life, and I could decide to do a project like GNU if I wanted to. But people used to ask me, what do you mean it's free software if it costs $150? They were confused because the word free has multiple meanings. One meaning means zero price, but another meaning refers to freedom. When we speak of free software, we're talking about freedom, not price. So think of free speech, not free beer. When you're saying it in Portuguese, always say livre. It's a much clearer word than the English word free, because people will know that you're talking about freedom and not price. So when you're speaking about free software in Portuguese, never use the English phrase free software. Always say software livre. It will be more clear. Some people got their copies of GNU Emacs from me through the net and did not pay me. Others got their copies from me on a tape and did pay me. And others got their copies not from me, but instead from somebody else. Maybe they paid that somebody else. I don't know. It was between them. But they didn't pay me. So GNU Emacs was free software for some users, and GNU Emacs was gratis for some users, and it was paid for some users, but it was free software for all of them, because all of them had the crucial freedoms that define free software. So let me now give you the detailed definition of free software. You see, it's very easy to say, I believe in freedom, but if you want to have a coherent position, you have to get more specific, because there are possible freedoms that conflict with each other, and you have to decide which are the important ones that society should protect and which are the secondary ones that have to give way if they conflict with the primary ones. So here now is the definition of free software. A program is free software for you, a particular user, if you have the following four freedoms. Freedom zero is the freedom to run the program for any purpose. Freedom one is the freedom to help yourself by studying the source code to see what the program does and then changing it to suit your needs or desires. Freedom two is the freedom to help your neighbor by distributing copies to others. And freedom three is the freedom to help build your community by publishing a modified version so others can benefit from your contributions. If you have all of these freedoms, then the program is free software for you. Please don't think of these as levels of freedom, because all of them are essential. If any of them is missing, then the program is non-free and you shouldn't use it. So why are these freedoms the important ones? Freedom zero, the freedom to run the program, is obviously necessary in order for you to be in control of your own computer. Freedom two, the freedom to distribute copies to others, is necessary so that on basic ethical grounds, because sharing copies of a program with other people is the fundamental act of friendship for computer users. And the spirit of doing so, the spirit of helping your neighbor, of goodwill towards others, is the most important resource of any society. It makes the difference between a livable society and a dog-eat-dog jungle. I'm falling asleep so much. I'm afraid I may just have to take a nap. I don't know what I can do about this.
Make a break and we continue.
I don't know what we should do. If we can get me a considerable amount of strong tea or some Pepsi.
We don't have a solution here of strong tea.
Well, it's easy to make strong tea. You just make sure the water is boiling and put the tea bag in. I don't like the taste of Coke. Also, there's a boycott of Coca-Cola for having paramilitary thugs kill union organizers in Colombia. They're being sued in the United States for this. The lawsuit has been going for a few years, and the judge recently refused to dismiss it, saying that there was a case to be considered. So don't buy Coca-Cola or things made by the Coca-Cola company. Well, I prefer to try to drink some caffeine and continue. What was the last thing I said? Before I said that I would have to pause, what was the last thing I said? Please tell me. No, before that, before I paused, where was I? Oh, I was talking about the most important resource of society, the spirit of goodwill. It's not a physical resource, it's a psychosocial resource. But it's absolutely essential. You know, no society ever has quite enough of this resource, but you can have more or less. And if you have more, society is better to live in. If you have less, it's really horrible. Oh, good. Good, good, good. Rescue is on the way. Just leave him here.
Choose one.
They're all the same, almost, so any of them. I'll try this kind. It's no coincidence that the world's major religions have been trying to encourage the spirit of helping your neighbor for thousands of years. So, if you use a non-free program and you don't have Freedom 2, the freedom to redistribute copies, then as soon as a friend comes and says, "Could I have a copy of that?" you face a moral dilemma. You either have to break the license or refuse to help your friend. You should do the lesser of the two evils, which is to help your friend, because your friend deserves your cooperation, and whoever deliberately tried to come between you and your friends does not deserve any kind of reward for that. But really, you should have thought in advance, when you started on the path that led you to that moral dilemma, when you started using that program yourself, when you agreed to such a license, you should have said no, and that way you would never find yourself in that moral dilemma. That's why you should use only free software. Then you can always share all the software you have, and you never have to be concerned about breaking any agreement or being attacked by the police just for helping your neighbor. But what does it mean, given the importance of this principle of the spirit of goodwill, what does it mean when major social institutions start telling you that it's wrong to copy and share? They're poisoning that resource, something no society can afford. And what does it mean when they start saying, if you share with your neighbor, you're a pirate? They're saying that helping your neighbor is the moral equivalent of attacking a ship, which is morality upside down. Because attacking a ship is very bad, but helping your neighbor is very good. And what does it mean when they start making harsh punishments, as the recent EU copyright directive involves, for people who share with their neighbor? How much fear do you think it's going to take to convince people not to help their neighbors, not to help their friends? That's going against human nature. It's going to take a lot of fear. And if you don't want to live in a society pervaded by this level of fear, you've got to do something about the problem of non-free software and the laws that prohibit sharing. In the United States, we are now seeing the beginning of the war on copying, which could be just as cruel and brutal as the war on drugs. In Argentina, a lot of people were sent letters by the equivalent of the Business Software Alliance saying, threatening them with being raped in prison if they used unauthorized copies of software. The only appropriate word for this is terror campaign. So by promoting free software, we can do something to reduce this state-sponsored terrorism that now threatens us all. Freedom 1 is necessary so that you can have control of your own computer. You see, when you don't have Freedom 1, when you can't study and change the source code, you don't control what the program does. The program's owner controls what it does, and you're stuck with it, and you can't even tell what it is. So all you can do is put blind faith in the developer. And the developers don't always deserve that. It's not rare to put in malicious features. Often programs will spy on you. For what? Yeah, it's sometimes people call that spyware. For instance, Windows XP, when it asks for an upgrade, sends Microsoft a list of the programs on your disk. It does so in encrypted form, so it was not easy for people to see that this was going on. People had to figure it out by some clever methods. This is not the first time. Several years ago, another version of Windows also came out with a spy feature to report that exact same information. But there was an uproar, so Microsoft took it out. And as you can see, they put it back in sneakily. And another spying feature is in Windows Media Player, which reports everything that you watch. It's not just Microsoft that does this. RealPlayer also reports what you watch. And so does the TiVo. So this kind of spying is actually fairly common. It's not limited to spying. Sometimes programs have features designed specifically to stop you from doing the things you want to do. For instance, DRM, Digital Restrictions Management, is a malicious feature designed to stop you from reading, stop you from copying, stop you from printing or whatever, stop you from doing various things with the information. And looking even to something even more bizarre, the Kazaa music sharing software had a secret feature. The developers didn't tell the users about this, but somebody figured it out. That they would sell time on your computer as part of a distributed computing scheme. And when they were confronted with this, they said, look at our license. Our license gives us permission to do just about anything with the user's computer. Yes, it doesn't specifically mention that we would sell time on the user's computer, but it gives us permission to do that along with almost anything else you could imagine. There is a piece of Microsoft software that has an internal symbol called NSA key, and another called NSA key 1. People speculate that this may have to do with some sort of back door put in for the sake of the NSA, but nobody really knows. However, what is clear is that if you allow your system to ask Microsoft for an upgrade, they can deliver a program customized for you if they want. They could deliver a version that simply doesn't run anymore. They can turn off your machine if they want. They can basically do anything at all to you. Now, not all developers of non-free software put in malicious features. Some of them really do their best to make the program useful for you. But they're human, so they make mistakes. These are called bugs. Every program has bugs. And you can't find the bugs either when you don't have Freedom 1. You're stuck with the program the way it was written, limited by the vision and skill of whoever the developer was. You have no recourse. With Freedom One, you can make the program do what you want, and thus you have control over your own computer. With a non-free program, the owner controls what your computer does. However, Freedom One is not enough. First of all, there are millions of people who don't know how to program. They can't exercise Freedom One. They can't personally study and change the source code. But even for programmers, Freedom One is not enough. Because there are too many programs. None of us has time to study all the different programs we use and be able to make changes in all of them. So if we're really going to have control of our computers, we need to be able to work together. We need to be able to form collectivities, often ad hoc collectivities. Any group of users, with Freedom 3, any group of users who want the same thing can get it. If there are a million users who want a certain change, perhaps 10,000 of them know how to program. And sooner or later, maybe 10 of them will get together and make that change. Then, given Freedom 3, the freedom to publish the modified version, they can make that change available for all the others of that million. They get the benefit of the change without having to implement the change themselves. And this is why free software means that even non-programmers have the freedom to control the software they use. It's true that the non-programmers won't be making changes personally, but if many people want a change, somebody will make it, and the non-free and then the non-programmers can use that version. So with free software, the users are in control of what the program does. And eventually it will do what they want. A group of non-programmers can also get together, pool their money, and then go to a programmer or programming company and say, how much will you charge to make this change, and when can you have it done? And if they don't like the answer from that company, they can go to another company and ask that company, what will you charge, and when can it be done? So, what this shows us is that with free software, there's a free market for support. By contrast, for non-free software, support is a monopoly because only the owner of the program can change it. If you have a choice between several non-free programs to do the same job, paradoxically, that's a choice between monopolies, because once you start using any of those programs, support for it will be a monopoly. This is why support for non-free software is usually so bad, because in support, the company has no competition. So for those that value support and want to get good support for their money, free software is the way to go. Now, it took a while for me to realize this, but this is not the first place where we have seen these freedoms. Cooks enjoy the same freedoms in using recipes. If you're a cook, you're free to cook the recipe. Cooks frequently get copies of recipes from their friends and make copies of recipes to give to their friends. It's not unusual to look at the ingredients of a recipe, checking whether those are all things that you want to eat and can get. It's not unusual to change your recipe. You know, leave out the salt because your doctor said you should eat less salt, or add some mushrooms, or whatever change you want to make. And if you're a good cook, maybe you'll cook your changed recipe for your friends, and a friend will say, that was great, could I have the recipe? And at that point, you could make your modified version of the recipe, write it down, and give your friend a copy. So these are the exact same freedoms. If you could imagine how cooks would feel if they were told that if you change or copy your recipe, you're a pirate and you'll be put in prison for years. That's exactly the way I felt when people told me I couldn't copy and change programs anymore. So these freedoms are necessary so that people can have control of their computers, form communities and cooperate, and live an ethical life treating other people decently. If you have all of these freedoms, the program is free software for you. The reason I say it that way, the reason I define free software relative to an arbitrarily chosen user, is because sometimes the same code can be free for some users and non-free for others. How does that happen? That might seem surprising. Let me give you an example to illustrate it. The X Window system was developed at MIT in the 1980s. And MIT released it under a free software license. The license used by MIT gave people all these essential freedoms. So if you got it from, if you got X from MIT, it was free software for you. But among those who got it from MIT were various computer manufacturers that distributed Unix systems. They took the source code of X, they modified it to run on their platform, they compiled it to make binaries, and put those binaries into their Unix system, and distributed only the binaries under the same non-disclosure agreement as the rest of Unix. Millions of users got copies that way. And for them, the X Window system was not free software at all. The result was a paradoxical situation. If you asked the question, is X free software or not, the answer depended on where you measured. If you made the measurement coming out of the developers group, you'd say, here I observe all the essential freedoms, it's free software. If you made the measurement among the users, you'd say, most of them don't have these freedoms, it's not free software. This paradox did not bother the developers of X because they weren't trying to give people freedom. Freedom was not their goal. They just wanted a big success. They wanted their software to be popular. As far as they were concerned, the millions of people using non-free versions of X were simply part of their success. But in the GNU project, our goal was specifically to give computer users freedom. If what happened to X had happened to us, for us it would have been failure. So I looked for a way to stop that from happening. The method I developed is called copyleft, or izquierdo autoral. The idea of copyleft is that you take copyright and flip it over. It uses copyright law, but instead of using this to stop users from sharing and stop users from changing things, we use it to protect everybody's freedom to copy and change the software. Here's how it works. We start with a copyright notice, the usual kind, that reminds people that the program is copyrighted, which means that by default, it is prohibited to copy or distribute or modify this program. But then we say, you are authorized to copy this. You are authorized to distribute copies. You are authorized to modify this. And you are authorized to publish a modified or extended version of the program. But there is a condition, and the condition is the reason why we go to all this trouble. The condition says any version of this program that you distribute, no matter how much modified or extended, as long as it still includes any substantial piece of the original program, must be distributed under these terms, no more and no less. Which means that your users must get from you the same freedom that you got from us. We ensure that every user of our code gets freedom by saying that it is prohibited for any middleman to strip off the freedom and pass along just the code without the freedom. The code and the freedom become legally inseparable, so that all users have freedom. In other words, these four freedoms I enumerated become inalienable rights, rights that nobody can give up or lose, other than as a punishment for some kind of wrongdoing. So, there is copylefted free software, and there is non-copylefted free software. Most free software packages are copylefted. Over two-thirds of all free software packages use the GNU General Public License, which is the copyleft license that I wrote. But the other non-copyleft licenses still can be free software licenses. For instance, X-Windows is free software. The developers of non-copylefted free software do respect your freedom. They don't try to take away your freedom. But they could go even further and do what we do with copyleft. We actively try to defend your freedom against anyone else who might try to take it away. The developers of non-free software don't do that. They respect your freedom, but they don't try to stop anyone else from taking away your freedom. So it's entirely up to you to recognize the value of your freedom and say no when any middleman tries to take it away. Unfortunately, what we see in our community is that not everybody has the firmness to do this. There are non-free versions of the X-Windows system today, and some of them are widely used. You can look at copyleft as defending the freedom for every user. You can also look at copyleft as a way of insisting that people who want to build on your work must contribute to the community. Nobody is required to start from our code when writing his program. With copyleft, we say that he can do that. He can start from our code as the base of his program. But if so, his whole program has to be free. So he can make use of what we have done only if he cooperates in both directions. You know, we're saying cooperation cannot be just one way. The people who want to build their software using the code of our community must contribute that software to our community as well if they distribute it. Anyone has the freedom to make a modified version and not publish it at all. You can use it privately. As long as you're using it privately, there is no obligation to ever distribute your modified version. But when you start using it publicly, distributing it to others, for instance, then copyleft licenses say you have to release the source code so other people can use your version in freedom. So the non-copylefted free software doesn't actively defend your freedom, but it does respect your freedom. The developers have not taken away your freedom. So we can use their software. It can be part of a free operating system. And in fact, X-Windows is part of the GNU system. All along in developing GNU, because I recognized the job was very large, I was looking for shortcuts. I was always trying to see, looking for any opportunity to get part of the system from some other project so that we would save time and not have to write it ourselves. From the very beginning, I wanted GNU to have a Windows system. Unix in 1984 did not have any kind of Windows system, but I had written a couple of Windows systems at MIT, and I wanted GNU to have that facility. But we never developed a Windows system for GNU, because before we got around to doing that, I saw X-Windows. I saw it was powerful and it was becoming a de facto standard. So I decided that we would not write our own Windows system, we would just use X. Because it was free software, that was a possible decision. So in the late 80s, 1988 or 89 or so, we decided to use X in the GNU system, and we started making other pieces of the GNU system work with X. And there were other occasions when somebody else had written a free program that we could use. I always took advantage of them when they happened because the job was so big. For instance, there is TEF, the text formatter, which existed even before the start of GNU. There are the Berkeley floating point library functions, which is a very tricky job to do and done in a very good way, and those were also free software. And there were others. But they only happened occasionally by luck, because the developers of those programs were not trying to make a complete free system. It was just an accident that they wrote free software that could be used in a free Unix-like operating system. So sometimes we were lucky and somebody else did a piece of the job for us. But the rest of the time, we had to do it. We had to write each of these programs or recruit somebody to write it. And that was our work during the 1980s. In October 1985, we started the Free Software Foundation, which is a tax-exempt charity to raise money for developing GNU and promoting free software. So the FSF raises money in various ways, for instance, by selling these key rings and selling books and T-shirts and so on. And also from donations and members. In the early days, the Free Software Foundation raised a lot of its money by selling copies of GNU Emacs and other free software. Once the foundation was started, the foundation started selling those tapes of Emacs, and I stopped because I didn't want to compete with the foundation. So I had to make a living in a different way. I began taking commissions to make improvements in the free programs I had written, and I began teaching classes. And I found it was actually easy to make a living that way. In fact, I made more than a living. Generally, I started making, you know, considerably more than I had made before. So I would put one-third to taxes, one-third to my living expenses, and one-third saved. And at that point, I'd say, I'm not going to take any more paying work this year. And in fact, I was able to support myself working for pay for 7 weeks a year, I calculated. And the rest of the time, I could work very hard without pay doing what was needed most. So we were filling in these various parts of the system. Some of this was done by staff hired by the Free Software Foundation. And in those days, that's mostly what we did with the money we raised. We hired programmers and technical writers to work on extending the system. But most of the some of the components that were done by FSF staff include the GNU shell bash and the GNU C library, which all user space programs use to talk to the kernel. But most of the work was done by volunteers. Some are full-time volunteers. For instance, I'm a full-time volunteer. This is because the foundation, as a matter of policy, does not pay me. You see, as the president of the foundation, when the foundation first had enough money to pay one person, I had to decide whether that would be me or someone else. It was my responsibility to spend the money effectively. And I realized that paying Stallman a salary would be throwing the money away because we could get Stallman to work for nothing. So it was my responsibility to spend the money instead hiring someone else, and I did so. In fact, we have many full-time volunteers, but most of them are getting paid by somebody else. For us, they're volunteers, but in another sense, they're employees. There are also thousands of part-time volunteers who really are not being paid by anyone for their work, but they do a lot of work, especially when you consider them all together. So, between all these different ways of contributing, and I hope you will be GNU volunteers as well, because there's a lot more work to be done. Between all these ways of contributing, during the 90s, we developed almost all of the pieces that were necessary for the initial system. By 1991, almost everything was done. Only one component was missing. That was the kernel. The kernel is the component that distributes the machine's resources to the other programs you run. We started developing a kernel in 1990 after having found a way to take a shortcut using code somebody else had developed. So as always, I was looking for such shortcuts. We found a microkernel developed as a funded project by Carnegie Mellon. And then the idea was, on top of that microkernel, we would implement the Unix kernel facilities as a collection of servers that communicated through message passing. And this way, we would be able to debug those servers as user programs, which I thought would make them easier to debug. I thought that this would enable us to get a system running in much less time. Now, for a combination of reasons, that plan didn't work out that way. It took many years to get the GNU kernel to run. One reason was the microkernel, the platform, was not as reliable as we hoped it would be. And another was it was missing some features, and we had to wait for the developers to implement them. And another was that the debugging environment we had was pretty bad. And another was the whole thing had the character of a research project. And the result was it took many years before it ran at all. It does run now. But fortunately, we did not have to wait for it, because in 1991, a Finnish college student named Linus Torvalds wrote his own kernel. initially it was not free software, but in 1992 he re-released it under a free software license, specifically under the GNU General Public License, and then it was free software. And then, well, initially we didn't know about this kernel called Linux, but he had announced it elsewhere, and people who knew about it wanted to look for all the rest of the system to put together with the kernel to make a complete system. They looked around, and lo and behold, everything they needed was already there. What good fortune, they said. But it was no accident that all the other parts of the system were already there and worked together. What they found, in fact, was the GNU system, which was almost complete, missing only a kernel. So really what they were doing was adding Linux to fill the gap in the GNU system, making the combined GNU plus Linux system. But they didn't realize that. They thought they were starting with Linux and adding all these other components around it, components which just happened to be the GNU system, but they didn't think about that. So they didn't know that they were adding Linux to the GNU system. They thought that they were starting with Linux and building up a system. And they called that larger, that combined system, a Linux system. And this confusion is the reason that today some tens of millions of people use a version of the GNU system. And they don't know it's a version of the GNU system. They think it's Linux. They think that the whole project was started by Linus Torvalds. They think he developed the main part of the system. And if they hear about GNU at all, they think that we were a project that developed various software tools. They love to use that word, tools, in the 1980s for no particular coherent overall reason or purpose. The development of Linux, the kernel, was a major contribution to the free software community because that was the step that carried us across the finish line. Thank you. Before that, we had 95% of an operating system. We had various components that you could use, but you'd have to install them on some other operating system, which was non-free. After Linux, we had an entire operating system, an entire free system, that you could actually install on a bare computer and run it. So, in fact, the goal that we had set out to achieve so many years before was reached with the help of this contribution. But the error of calling the entire system Linux was a major blow to the free software movement because it broke the connection from our software to our philosophy. Before that, there were people who used various pieces of GNU on top of some other system. And they knew that they were installing these GNU programs on that other system, and they thought of themselves as GNU users and often were fans of GNU. And so when they saw the articles that talked about our philosophy, they would realize that this had a relationship to them, that this was the reason for the software that they liked. That didn't mean that they would have to agree with us, but at least they would probably give it a serious look. And if they did agree with us, they would then feel motivated to... They would then, and it's the same philosophy I'm telling you today, then they would feel a motivation to develop more free software to add to GNU. So the software spread the philosophy, and the philosophy extended the software. But when people started using essentially the entire GNU system and thinking of it as Linux, then instead of being led to look at our philosophy, they were led to the apolitical philosophy of Linus Torvalds, a philosophy which said that this is not a matter of right and wrong at all. Linus Torvalds thinks that non-free software is perfectly legitimate. Until recently, he was developing non-free software in his job, and he's still using non-free software in a very public way, which I think is bad. It's not carrying out his responsibility to the community. He's setting a bad example and leading other people to make programs non-free. So ever since then, it's been difficult for us to place our philosophy in front of the users for them to consider it. And if they do find out about us and see our philosophy, they're likely to say, what has that got to do with me? I'm a Linux user. Now, this is so ironic because, in fact, they're users of the GNU system, but they don't know that, so they think the GNU philosophy is irrelevant to them. And they may say, this seems very impractical. This, to be so idealistic is certainly impractical. Well, if only they knew that the system they love is the practical result of our idealism, they might still disagree with us, but they could hardly say the philosophy is impractical. Actually, as a general principle, they're completely mistaken. They think that idealism is impractical. But when you're trying to do a very big job, there is nothing more practical than idealism. Idealism is essential unless you have billions of dollars to spend. Because idealism will enable you to keep on moving for years until you reach the distant goal. Nothing else will do it. And sometimes they say something even more ironic. They say, this emphasis on freedom is a mistake because it gets in the way of the success of Linux. Look at all the irony here. They're not just confused about what Linux is, they're confused about what success is, too. They think success is just popularity. They think that the most important goal in our community is just to increase the numbers of, quote, Linux, unquote. And they don't really understand what Linux is. They've got a confused idea of what Linux is, which in some ways means the kernel, and in some ways means the entire GNU system. And they don't even realize that these are two different things. Why do they think that popularity is the goal? Probably because they carried it over from non-free software without questioning whether it makes sense. For non-free software developers, typically popularity is their goal. And there's a logical reason for it, because they expect that each user is going to pay them, so more users means more money. It's evil, but at least it's logical. So then they go over to the world of free software, and they carry this definition of success over to free software without questioning it, without thinking about it. But really, why should we be attached to the popularity of a certain kernel, the kernel Linux? Well, it's free software, It does its job. By all means, use it if you want to use it. But the mere popularity of this kernel is not so important that we should make it our goal. Why should we be terribly obsessed with the popularity of one program? Now, there are some who think that when they talk about the popularity, the success of Linux, they're really talking about the GNU system. But why should we become that attached to the popularity of one particular operating system? It's a nice system. I'm proud that I launched its development. And you could forgive me if I feel somewhat attached to the popularity of GNU. But even I realize that the popularity of GNU is not the overall goal, because there's something more important at stake here, and that is freedom. GNU is a means to an end. It's a way that we can live in freedom and use computers. And freedom is the goal that really matters. If we want to make the GNU system a success, then we don't just want more users. We want it to contribute to leading people to freedom. Now, this makes a practical difference, because if you think that the goal is popularity for the GNU system, then when Oracle releases a non-free database that runs on the GNU system, on the Linux-based version of the GNU system, the GNU/Linux system it is, then you might think that's a good thing because it will encourage more users to adopt the GNU plus Linux system. But if you realize that freedom is what really matters, then you will recognize that because Oracle's database is non-free, then it can't be a good thing. A system of dominating people and keeping them divided cannot be a good thing, even if it helps our project become more popular. So there are real practical issues of what we should do that depend on recognizing the right goal. If we forget the goal of freedom, if we pick some other goal, like popularity, we will drift off the road. We'll do things that don't contribute to freedom. And that is happening a lot in our community. For instance, and if we look at all the institutions in our community, we can see that most of them call the system Linux, and most of them talk about open source rather than free software. Open source is the slogan of the people who don't want to talk about freedom as an ideal. And most of them say in various ways that it's legitimate to use non-free software. Consider, for instance, the companies that distribute versions of the GNU/Linux system. All of them include non-free software in their products. The result is that while it's easy to find a version of the GNU system in a store, labeled probably as Linux, it's hard to find a version that is entirely free software. If you want to use those commercial distributions and install a completely free operating system, you have to be an expert. You have to be able to figure out which parts are not free and leave them out. They don't help you. They don't point to certain parts and say, this is not really free software. So you might want to avoid this, because they would like you to be grateful, to be appreciative of the non-free software they put on the CD. They want you to think of that as a bonus. The last thing they'd ever want is for you to come to believe that there's something bad about non-free software. They don't want you to think as a citizen instead of a consumer. So they're not going to help teach people to be aware of the value of freedom, and they don't. Then look at the magazines about the GNU/Linux system. There are many of those, and they typically are called Linux something. So they're calling the system Linux. And they typically are filled with ads for non-free software. Now, those ads describe various different products, but there's a message they all have in common. They're saying non-free software is good for you, so good you might even pay to get a copy, which I think is all wrong. I'd pay to get rid of a copy. In fact, I spent 20 years of my life to get rid of it. So the attitude of those advertisements is the exact opposite of the spirit of the free software movement. We're saying, join us in working to escape from non-free software, and they're saying, work hard so you can have some non-free software. They call these things value-added packages, which makes a statement about values. It says, value convenience, not your freedom. I think that's completely wrong, so I have a different term for those packages. I call them freedom subtracted packages. Because if you are running a complete free operating system, if you are enjoying the freedom that we have worked for 20 years to bring to you, those programs give you an opportunity to put on a chain somewhere. And what about the trade shows dedicated to the GNU/Linux system? Most of them call the system Linux because the show itself is called Linux something. And they're filled with companies presenting non-free software. In effect, putting the show's seal of approval on the non-free software, saying it's legitimate. And what about the users groups for users of the GNU/Linux system? Typically, they are called Linux user groups, calling the entire system Linux. And most of them invite people to come and make presentations of non-free software, encouraging the public to use that non-free software, and thus putting the group's seal of approval on non-free software. So all through our community, you see institutions, organizations that call the system Linux and treat non-free software as legitimate. Yep, it's still up there. Boy, it's strange. So where did you find the idea that freedom is the goal and freedom is worth working for? You find that in the GNU project and the free software movement. Just by calling the system GNU/Linux and helping make the other users aware of where it really came from, you can help us present our philosophy of freedom to the public. I'm really tired now. In fact, that's the easiest way that you can help us, because it takes just a few seconds a day, and it will help make the people who know about and use the system aware of where it really came from and why. The why part is the most important. We can talk to people, but if they don't know that they're using our system, they may not listen. So if you prepare them by informing them they're using a version of GNU, then they're more likely to listen, and our efforts, our work, will be more effective. Now, sometimes people say to me, though, it looks bad to ask for credit, and people will assume that you're doing it for reasons of just ego, whether it's true or not. So instead of doing that, just let the matter drop, and when people call the system Linux, you can smile to yourself and take pride in a job well done. That would be very wise advice if it were true that the job is done. But our job is far from finished. We have made a great start, but there's a lot more we have to do. Consider, we have developed free operating systems, free graphical interfaces, free office suites, but there are many more free software applications that we need. So the job is not finished. And then consider, there are tens of millions of people using the GNU/Linux system, but there are hundreds of millions of computers. So the majority of these computers are not running free software at all. So we have a lot of work to do. And today we have something we never had before. We have enemies. Powerful corporations trying very hard to stop us from doing this work. What are the threats that we face? One of the problems is the tendency to keep the workings of hardware a secret. For instance, there is a free BIOS, but it's very hard to get the specifications for any computers so that we can make the free BIOS run on them. There are very few computers that support it. It's really hard to do anything about this. And the same is true for many hardware devices. For instance, there are some graphics chips whose specifications are secret. And if you want to operate them and get the full power of them doing 3D graphics, only non-free drivers will allow that. And you can't use a non-free driver ethically. So somehow or other, we have to convince those companies to start publishing their specifications. Now, perhaps if our entire community would refuse to buy that hardware until they do it, perhaps that would have the effect. But most of the people in our community are not aware of this as a problem because they're not used to thinking of freedom as the issue. So we fail to use the market power that we have. The future of our community depends on what we value. In fact, it depends on what we value more than on anything else. If we value freedom enough, we can fight for our freedom and maybe eventually win. If we don't value our freedom, we'll surely lose it. Another threat comes from laws like the Digital Millennium Copyright Act in the U.S. and its counterpart, the EU Copyright Directive. Laws that can prohibit certain free software. The Digital Millennium Copyright Act has been interpreted by the courts to prohibit free software to play a DVD. If you buy a DVD, then it's lawful for you to play it. But free software that would enable you to put your DVD into a computer running GNU/Linux and then play it with entirely free software has been censored in the U.S. And that may happen now in Europe as well because of the EU Copyright Directive. The EU Copyright Directive can be implemented in various ways, either more cruel or less cruel. I think it is possible to implement the directive saying that a free software package that does the exact same job as the authorized package is legitimate. And that would authorize free software to read a DVD and display the film on the screen. That would authorize free software that would read a corrupt disk and play the sound. And that's at least better than nothing. The danger is if the EU's copyright directive is implemented in a harsh fashion, then free software to do these jobs will be completely illegal. And people who want to do them will be stuck with only the non-free software. And it may also be the case that this non-free software runs only on Windows. So we face a danger there, but there's an even bigger danger that comes from software patents. When I say software patents, I really mean patents that cover ideas used in software. If a country allows software patents, that means you can get sued for patent infringement just for writing and either releasing or using a program. And the thing that makes this so dangerous is that patents cover ideas. A software patent covers an idea that can be used in a program. But if you've looked at a modern program, you've seen they generally combine lots of ideas, maybe hundreds, maybe thousands of different ideas in one program. If you look at a word processor, you'll see hundreds of features. Each feature is at least one idea. It could be patented in at least one way, maybe several, by different people at the same time. The result is that a modern program is vulnerable at many points at once. Developing a modern program means combining many ideas, and each one of them could get you sued. So software development with a system of software patents is like crossing a minefield. With each design decision, chances are nothing will happen, but there's a certain chance you will step on a patent that will explode and destroy your project. Right now, Europe is deciding whether to have software patents. The European Parliament voted about 3 weeks ago on a directive on patents on computer-implemented inventions. Now, computer-implemented inventions includes things like a machine in a factory with a computer to control it. But it can also include patents on pure software ideas. The question is, would it? The European Commission said that the directive would not allow software patents, but that was a deception because the words that they proposed would have allowed software patents. The European Parliament voted amendments to this directive which close off the danger of software patents. In fact, the directive is now a good one with all the amendments that the Parliament voted. Now the job is to make sure that they stand firm, because next this directive is going to the Council of Ministers, and who knows whether they will change it and make it dangerous again. And if they do, the Parliament's going to have to give it a second reading and vote again, and is going to have to make sure that they insist on closing off the danger, not just closing half the doors while leaving the other half open, That doesn't help. They have to close all the loopholes that might allow software patents, or Europe is going to have the same problem that the U.S. already has. Software patents are a big problem because they can affect any kind of software in any field at all, any application. Things may be patented. And Microsoft is already trying very hard to get people trapped in patented interfaces. The file format of Windows Media Player is patented. So nobody in the U.S. is allowed to interoperate with Windows Media Player. And they are trying to do the same thing with .NET. Some of the specifications are patented so as not to allow compatible implementations. But Europe will avoid that problem if Europe rejects software patents. So it is necessary to start speaking to people in the government of Portugal right now. Lots of you have to do this. Go to their offices, make appointments to see the legislators, convince them that software patents are stupid and dangerous. Look at the site www.ffii.org for more information, for full information on the danger of software patents, on the proposed directive, on what has to be done to make it a good directive, and then go talk to your members of parliament and ministers now. The most insidious threat we face does not involve a new law. It involves a conspiracy to redesign all computers so that they will no longer obey their owners. This scheme is called trusted computing by its proponents. But that name is a deception, because what they really mean is that application developers can trust your computer to obey them and not obey you. So from your point of view, the term treacherous computing is a more accurate one. The idea is that data can be written in a format that no unauthorized program can possibly read, or else it's illegal to make a program to read that format. Depending on the details, it could be one or the other. Of course, they plan to use this for published data, like music and films and books. And that's already an intolerable attack on our freedom. DRM is theft. But they won't stop there. They plan to use it for your data too, as a means of locking the user in. Imagine if 5 years from now, treacherous computing is normal. Microsoft could change Word to use a new version of Word format that's based on treacherous computing. And then it will be impossible or illegal for any program to read Word format. You see, right now, it's difficult to make free software support Word format because Microsoft keeps the format secret. And this is another example of a threat to free software, because users want to be able to use our software on the data formats that they use. But the designers of those data formats are deliberately making that difficult for us. But today, we can implement support for Word format to the extent we figure it out. With treacherous computing, that will no longer be true. Treacherous computing is being imposed on us by a conspiracy of many large companies. I know this is true because they say so. This is not a secret conspiracy. It's an open, announced conspiracy. These companies include IBM, Intel, AMD, Microsoft, HP, Sun, Transmeta, and many others, all working together to take the control of our computers away from us. To fight them is going to be difficult. I think we may need the support of some governments that might be prepared to prohibit treacherous computing. And it should be prohibited because it's a threat to competition. You know, even if you don't think that free software is an important issue, there are other reasons why, as a matter of simple competition law and consumer protection, you would want to prohibit treacherous computing. We also need to organize by the millions to put pressure on companies that cooperate with treacherous computing, to pressure at least one of these companies to break ranks and separate itself from the conspiracy. And then we can put pressure on another one, one at a time. It's not going to be easy for the public to get to be stronger than these corporations, especially with so many governments bowing down to corporate rule. But when they do that, they destroy, they abolish democracy. And we can use that to recruit people to join in. If computer users knew what treacherous computing would mean for them in the future, they'd be very angry. We have to teach them. So I hope that you will form organizations to campaign to put an end to treacherous computing in our lifetime. But the first order of business is software patents, so please work on that first. Now, at this point, I'm just about done with my talk. I'd like to mention that we have some things that you can buy and support the Free Software Foundation. For instance, we have these metal pins, and we have these key rings. And I hope that not many of you will be able to wear these, but we also have tie clips. I hope you don't wear ties. But if you do, you could consider getting one of these. And we also have some T-shirts, and we also have some books. We have this book of my essays, Free Software, Free Society, and we have various manuals also. Oh, and here are some more stickers, but there are probably still some stickers left. So buying these is a way you can, with these things you can help make people aware of GNU and also support us. If you buy the books, you can learn about GNU and also support us. You can also just give a donation if you wish. In addition, I have these. Where are they? Oh, here they are. These are some contact forms. If you would like to tell the Free Software Foundation how to get in touch with you, you can fill out one of these and hand it back to me today. Don't take it away because you won't go to the trouble of mailing it in. Just hand it right back to me. It's less work. A lot of the foundation's support comes from individual associate members. If you want to be a member, you can use these cards to do it. So ask me for a card if you want to use it. You can also do that through our website. So now I will finish by introducing my alter ego. Sometimes people criticize my holier-than-thou attitude. Well, sometimes people accuse me of having a holier-than-thou attitude. And they're right. I am holy. I'm a saint, so it's my job to be holy. I am Saint Ignatius of the Church of Emacs. I bless your computer, my child. Emacs started out as a text editor, which then became a way of life for many users, and ultimately a religion. We even have a great schism between two rival versions of Emacs, and now we have saints too, fortunately no gods. To be a member of the Church of Emacs, you must recite the Confession of the Faith. You must say, there is no system but GNU, and Linux is one of its kernels. The Church of Emacs has advantages compared with some other churches I might name. For instance, to be a saint in the Church of Emacs does not require celibacy. So if you're looking for a church to be holy in, you would do well to consider ours. But it does require living a life of moral purity. You must exorcise the evil proprietary operating systems that possess the computers, all the computers under your direct practical control, and then install a wholly free operating system to replace it, wholly being spelled two different ways, and then only install free software on top of that. If you can make this vow, if you make this vow and then live by it, then you too will be a saint. And you may eventually have a halo, if you can find one, because they don't make them anymore. Sometimes people ask me if it is a sin in the Church of Emacs to use the editor VI. The answer is that using a free version of VI is not a sin, it's a penance. And sometimes people ask me if my halo is really an old computer disk. This is no computer disk. This is my halo. But it was a computer disk in a previous existence. So thank you. And I guess, should I ask for questions first, or should we sell these things now?
You should have the questions first, later.
Okay, I'll ask for questions first. Please speak very loud when you're asking a question, because I have a bit of hearing loss.
Si
are there any questions?
Si alguien quisiera puede preguntar en portugués y intentamos traducir.
Nobody's raising his hand. I guess there are no questions. Probably with all my sleeping and so on, we went on for so long that you're all tired now. Well, if there are no... Are you raising your hand? If you... Oh, okay. Well, no, you don't have to push someone else to ask. That's... We don't know who's going to win. We're fighting for freedom. And the outcome depends on how many people join in and fight. So the right question to ask is not who's going to win, but what should I do? How can I, what's the right, which side is right, and how can I help that side? That's the question you should ask when there's a political battle going on. If enough people join in and demand freedom, we will win. I think, okay, the lesser general public license is an alternate form of copyleft license that allows linking a library into a non-free combination program. And as a result, we call it lesser because it does less to protect people's freedom. But sometimes, for strategic reasons, it's a good strategy to use that in certain special cases. Most of the time, you should not use that. You certainly shouldn't permit using your code in non-free software merely because it would be more popular that way. We have to keep in mind the goal of winning freedom and not settle for mere popularity.
Is there any other question?
Or can I go to sleep now? Yes, all else being equal, we would rather have more people use our software. Especially because if more people switch entirely to free software, that means we have brought freedom to more people. And that is definitely the goal. We just have to recognize that sometimes not all else is equal. And we have to avoid compromising freedom for the sake of popularity. Well, that's confused because, you see, spyware means the developer wrote the program to spy on the user. Freedom Zero is a freedom for the user. So that says nothing about whether there should be spyware. Now, Freedom Zero by itself doesn't say whether there is spyware or not. And in fact, the definition of free software doesn't say whether it spies on you or not. But if the program is free software, then the users are in control. If the program was written to spy on you and it's free software, you can change it so it doesn't spy. Well, change it to do a malicious job. That's a different question from malicious use. I mean, both of them are possible. You could take GNU Emacs and edit a list of people that you're planning to kill, right? And I wouldn't like that. But when, you know, someone who makes typewriters would have the same problem. You could buy the typewriter and use it to type up a list of people you're going to kill, all right? That use is wrong, but you can't blame the general purpose tool because somebody uses it for something wrong. You can buy a car and use it to run somebody over with. Well, I don't think we should say that cars are bad because of that. However, it's also possible with free software to modify the program to do something bad to its users. And I wouldn't like that. But I don't see it as a major problem because with free software, the users are in control. If somebody modifies a free program to do something malicious, his version is not going to be very popular because it's not going to be hard for people to see it's malicious, and then they won't use it. They'll pick a different version, a version that doesn't have the malicious features. The only place where malicious features are not easy to get rid of is in non-free software. So that's where they become a real danger. The developer of a non-free program can put in malicious features and figure that you have no real choice, that you can't get another program to do the same job, that to interoperate. So you're just going to have to accept the malicious features, and you can't remove them. I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you. I was yawning. Could you say it again? Many large enterprises are users of free software. Remember that most businesses are not software developers, but most businesses do use software, especially large ones. And freedom is useful for them and important for them in their computer use, just as it's important for anyone else. So the answer is most certainly yes. Now, whether, and even large businesses in the computer field can coexist with and use free software. It might not be possible to have a large business that develops software, but so what? I think I should mention that there is a special reason why governments should use free software. Governments have a responsibility to their citizens to maintain control of what they do with their data. And to maintain control, they have to be using free software so that they can assure themselves of what the programs do and change that when necessary. There are also special reasons why all schools should use free software exclusively. One is, of course, they can save money this way, and that's useful. But that's superficial. The next reason is to train adults who are disposed to use free software. That will be a tremendous efficiency for the society as a whole, because it will remove a big drain on the economy and encourage money to circulate within each region instead of draining out to a few rich companies, typically foreign companies. Another reason that's somewhat deeper is to encourage education. You see, non-free software prohibits education. It's the opposite of the spirit of education, because it says you're not allowed to learn how this works. But free software says, go ahead and learn. If you're curious, you can learn whatever you want. If high schools use free software, then that's just the right age for many people to become very curious about how software works. So if the school is using free software, those people will be able to learn. And they will be able to then develop their skill by changing the free software. The way you learn to be a good programmer is by reading lots of code and writing lots of code. And you have to be able to practice writing parts of large programs in order to learn how to write a large program. But while you're still learning, you can't write a useful large program on your own. So you need to be able to write small changes in an existing large program. That's an easier job. That's something you can do as a beginner. And by doing it, you'll develop your skill, and eventually you will be able to write a large program yourself. So by making the high school switch to free software, they can offer a conducive environment to anyone who wants to learn all about how to be a good programmer. But there's an even more important reason. Schools should teach not just facts, not just skills, but above all, good character. They should teach people to be good citizens. This means teaching them the spirit of goodwill, the willingness to help out other people around them. So every school should have a rule. If you bring software to school, you can't keep it for yourself. You have to share it with the other students, which means that non-free software is not allowed. Every school should switch to free software and use only free software to teach people the right attitude towards their fellows in society. It says any later version published by the Free Software Foundation. So there's no danger somebody else could publish something and say that this is version 3 of the GNU GPL and that that would have any legal force. We're not dying now.
Can I add something? In fact, even if that happened, if it's not possible, but if it was possible that someone evil brings that version 3, the version itself says that you as the user can choose either version 2 or later. So you can choose to use version 2 and not use version 3. If you find that version 3 doesn't give you the freedom you wanted, you will stick with version 2. Because it says you can use either version 2 or any later version. Yes, but if they did, they cannot do it. But even if they could, you could still say, I'm using version 2, and I'm keeping the freedoms that were given by version 2.
Yes. If version 3 allowed that, that would be possible. Yes, that's right. There's a reason for this. There's a reason for this. Because someday we're going to issue version 3 of the GPL, or at least I hope we are. And at that point, people will start releasing programs under version 3 or later that won't be licensed under version 2. So then what happens? You have these programs that, if programs were released only under version 2 and others were released only under version 3, then they would be incompatible licenses. You couldn't combine them anymore. So by saying this is version 2 or later and this is version 3 or later, they become compatible. So this is a way we can automatically shift over to version 3. And we will not split the entire code base once we do. Nobody knows of a better way to solve this problem. Sorry, who writes free software? Oh, well, I'm the president. There are 5 people on the board of directors, and they're chosen, I don't know if you've heard of them, but the point is that one of them you may have heard of is Eben Moglen, and we chose them because they are very strongly determined to promote free software. That's the main mission of people on the FSF's board of directors, is to be steadfast so that they won't let the organization drift away from its mission or make bad compromises. Now, I'm not against compromise. If you're compromising on the details of how you do things, that's necessary in order to work with people. But when you compromise away your goals, that destroys the purpose of what you're doing. So we don't do that. Well, sorry, no. Free software is software. The Free Software Foundation is run by its board of directors. Now, it also has employees, about 10 of them, who are doing various kinds of work. But the board of directors are the ones who make sure that it doesn't deviate from its principles. That's not an important question. Please let me explain. It's not necessary. If our goal is to use free software, we need to have lots of free software developed. But it doesn't have to be developed by people who are getting paid. Because, in fact, most of it's developed by volunteers anyway. There are about 1 million developers of free software. Most of them are part-time, unpaid volunteers, but they get a lot of work done. So we don't need to have paid people doing it. To the extent that we can find ways to fund people to work on free software, that's better. If you find a way, by all means do it. I'm not saying it's bad if you can get paid to write free software. But we should not regard it as a crucial problem to pay more people. We should do that to the extent we can, but we can succeed anyway. We have succeeded a tremendous amount without that. There are probably only thousands of people getting paid to write free software, which is much less than a million. But, you know, it would be nice to increase that, but we shouldn't think of it as necessary. You see, the argument goes, it's hard to get paid to develop free software, and the next step is, so there won't be enough free software. And we know the second part of the argument is false. So we shouldn't worry too much about the first part. Now, if you want to try to get a job developing free software, the best way to find it is to work on free software as a volunteer, show people that you're good at it, become a part of the community, and learn how the community works. And the more involved you are in the community, the better chance there is that you'll find one of these opportunities when it comes along. I should point out that governments fund a lot of software development, and that whenever this software is going to be available to the public, it could just as well be free software. I'm sorry, I was yawning, so I couldn't hear you. Could you speak again and louder? Towards what? There's a word I don't hear. Oh, hardware. It's not exactly hard. It's not that the hardware is proprietary. It's that, because proprietary means non-free. And hardware is never free in the same sense, because it doesn't matter, because there are no copiers. Whether you're free to put your computer in a copier would be an important question if we had computer copiers, but we don't have them. So the issue is actually whether the specifications are public. No, but you and I don't have them. They're not really copiers. They don't make computers through a copying process. They don't make computers by starting with one computer and putting it into something that copies that computer. They make computers by building them out of parts. And the parts have been manufactured too, and usually not by copying. The chips themselves are made by a photographic reproduction process, but they're not made by copying a chip. They're made from photographic masks. Right. The point is that it's not a relevant question, because there is no technology that would enable you and me to take a computer and copy it. However, so therefore the issue that does matter is whether the specifications of that computer are free, are public, that is. If we can get the specifications, we can write free software to use it. Please make the question short. He can't translate a. Nobody can remember a long question to translate it.
Go ahead.
So please make it brief. If you you could please terminate your question. Can you guess what the whole question can translate
for me? Let him do. Para ayudar. Okay, the question was still for a non-technical user or someone who's not familiar with computing. It's still very hard to install a GNU Linux system. So what can the FSF or the free software community do to help them?
Well, obviously people are working on making installation easier. There are various efforts, some of which are hard jobs, like automatically recognizing your hardware, which are not, they're not easy, but I think I heard that Red Hat worked on that and has produced something to free software to automatically recognize your hardware. So that could be you can make installation easier. However, the thing to realize is there's no reason for non-wizards to do their own installation unless they want to. Just go to a users group and say, please install it for me. That's the easy solution. The easy way to get the system installed is have some expert do it. Don't do it yourself.
Well, I should add that in Portugal, you can already buy some computers with GNU Linux installed. That's what I did. The laptop I have came with the Red Hat already installed and working, so I didn't have to do anything. Well, I did some changes, but it already it's being sold by some Portuguese companies with the system already installed. Any more questions?
I think it would be good to call it halt now.
Yeah, okay.
And so if you're interested in getting books or shirts or these pins and keychains, come up. And is there are there any left of that roll of stickers? Okay, just bring it back. And if you want to become an FSF member or just give us your address, you can do that.
Okay, vamos a agradecer Richard Stallman más una vez.